Welcome to the podcast series for AJP Heart and Circulatory Physiology. I'm your host, Kara Hansel-Keehan. Today, we'll discuss the article by Brooks and Lindsay et al. Titled, Guidelines for Authors and Reviewers on Antibody Use in Physiology Studies. This article was published January 5th, 2018. Joining me today are Editor-in-Chief Irv Zucker, Deputy Editor and Author Mary Lindsay, author Hedwin Brooks, and content expert John Hollander. Let's get started.
Thank you, Kara, and thank you all for participating in this important discussion. This is the second podcast in our Guidelines in Cardiovascular Research series, and we strongly believe that these articles and podcasts will be of great benefit to cardiovascular research community. Now, it's almost impossible to avoid using antibodies in biological research today, especially if the work is focused on cellular and molecular mechanisms. This guidelines paper was developed in an effort to help the cardiovascular research community validate their reagents, and I think it does a great job overall at giving guidance to investigators at all levels. Hedwin, maybe you can start by telling our listeners why the paper was done and really what's the importance of this guidelines paper.
Thanks, Irv. Yes. So many physiology studies these days use antibodies. Most of us are using them for immunohistochemistry or for immunoblotting. And we're evaluating the expression of specific proteins in the cells of tissue of interest. Now, with the ongoing discussions of rigor and reproducibility, we saw this as an excellent opportunity to establish and clarify guidelines for such antibody use.
Mary, comments?
That's exactly right, Irv and Hedwin. We saw a need to provide details on what controls should be performed and what information should be recorded to ensure both rigor and reproducibility when using antibodies for physiology research.
John, would you like to add anything?
Yeah, I'm in agreement with both Hedwin and Mary. This manuscript is certainly timely, and the guidelines are consistent with NIH and the general public's desire for researchers to pay close attention to rigor and reproducibility in biomedical research.
Thanks, John. You know, all investigators should be their own best critics. And you evaluated AJP Heart and Circ literature to assess current reporting of antibody use. Mary, why did you use this evaluation? And maybe you can describe the methodology that you and Hedwin used to derive this data.
Right, Irv. Well, we wanted to see, first of all, how many AJP Heart articles are using antibodies, so to give us a percentage idea of how common their use is. And then second, to tell how they're reporting their use. And so we pulled out all of the articles from AJP Heart in the last few years that are using antibodies, and then we took a subsection of those articles and did an in-depth analysis.
Yeah, you really did. John, you've gone through this paper. You want to comment on the kinds of analyses that Mary and Hedwin performed on these AJP Heart and Circ papers?
Absolutely, Irv. You know, I was really surprised to see how much information was actually not provided in these papers. For example, whether analyses were done blinded by the investigator, these were not necessarily addressed, and the authors would not necessarily state in one case or another whether they actually performed the experimentation in a blinded fashion. That was very interesting to me.
I think that's the case in many journals. Hedwin, you want to add any comments to what John just said?
Yes, that's an important point. This is really more of an issue for immunohistochemistry because, as we all know, blinding a Western is usually unnecessary because the samples are being run on the same gel and membrane, and we're all very familiar in how to analyze that. However, in immunohistochemistry, blinding is important, and we found that investigators did not report if they knew which section they were performing the method on and the analysis. In fact, whether it was blinded or not was not reported 64% of the time.
That's a very interesting statistic. What about immunoblotting in terms of reporting methodology? Edwin?
Yes, for Western blotting, we found that when documenting immunoblotting, the methods were vague 59% of the time. Another thing that we found was that only one sample per group was shown on a blot, and this was usual about 73% of the time. And 86% of Western blots did not use positive controls for the antibody of interest.
And I can add for the immunohistochemistry, in addition to the blinding issue that both John and Hedwin have discussed, 27% of these papers had vague methods describing how they did their immunohistochemistry. I was surprised to see that 36% did not quantify their results, 73% did not report if they used controls, and 36% did not report the catalog number or even the dilution that they used. And so it was interesting that of the antibodies used, 100% of the papers we analyzed had commercial antibodies, which tells us that establishing guidelines for antibodies developed by individual laboratories is no longer a priority.
You know, I agree with you, Mary. The bigger priority is helping investigators understand that commercial antibodies are not always vetted by the company, and that each lab needs to set up their own control experiments. Clearly, this is not necessarily occurring in all laboratories or necessarily in all studies.
Agreed. And one of the key points to get across to authors and to the public is that authors are not hiding the details on purpose. Rather, it's the lack of uniformity that is requested for all manuscripts. For instance, different journals have different requirements. But having a checklist, and this would we refer you to Table 3 in our article, this will go a long way to helping both authors and reviewers ensure that enough details are included to allow the data quality assessment.
I thought the checklist was very useful. What other resources did you provide in this article that would help investigators? Hedwin?
We provided a list of antibody search sites so that you can look for the information that includes examples of staining and validation information for specific antibodies, commercial antibodies, as well as a list of society resources that provide checklists and other guidance as you're going to perform these techniques.
Mary, you want to add to that?
We also give recommendations for controls in particular. It's a balance between the need to adequately assess binding specificity for that antibody and the need to be productive. And so we give ideas and suggestions on the minimum positive and negative controls that should be included.
We also listed our minimum details that we thought should be provided in the methods and results that will allow reviewers and readers and future researchers to assess the experiments.
And we provided a template for lab notebooks to record information that will make it easy for authors to provide those minimum details when writing the manuscript. This also provides an easy way to troubleshoot when the experiments aren't working.
That's a good point. John, would you like to add anything?
Sure. What was most interesting to me was actually the inclusion of the pie graphs that showed the various inconsistencies in the immunoblotting and immunohistochemistry data evaluated in the studies. To me, that data was eye-opening. There certainly are a lot of pitfalls that need to be considered when performing experiments with the antibodies, and I think that data illustrated that point very well.
This is great. I think that the tables are very very interesting. The analysis and the pie charts that are in the article are really eye-opening. We would hope that every journal went through this kind of analysis. I wonder, just to make the podcast a little bit more interesting and easier for listeners to digest, I wonder if each of you could just highlight some of the important ways one can add specificity or demonstrate specificity of their antibodies. There are a variety of techniques that people can use, and we may not be able to use all in every study. Mary, do you want to start?
Sure. The main thing I would say would be to have a positive and a negative control for every antibody that you use. It doesn't have to be extensive, 10 positives and 10 negatives, but one good positive and one good negative.
Mm-hmm. And for a negative control, what would you recommend? Blocking peptides, null animals, those sorts of things?
So the gold standard negative control would be a tissue sample from a knockout animal where the gene of interest that your antibody is looking at, that protein, that gene is missing from that animal. That's kind of the gold standard. But just any tissue that you know would be negative for that protein would be an ideal, adequate negative control.
Hedwin, anything else?
I think specifically for immunohistochemistry, people have gone away from the idea of just using a secondary antibody control. And often we look at staining that looks like background or different staining between samples. So I think including a secondary control without a primary antibody is always a good procedure to tell your students and postdocs to do when they're doing these methods.
Mm-hmm. In cell-based experiments, how does everyone feel about using things like an siRNA to knock down a gene and show that the antibody works on that specific band, using blocking peptides, those sorts of things?
Well, that's certainly one way to do it. It's not necessarily the mandatory way to do it. And so there's a lot. I think that's one point, Irv, that we need to get across to authors as they're designing their experiments, is we're not necessarily saying that you have to do super, super stringent, you know, very expensive, very extensive controls. You just need to do enough so that, like I said, if you have the positive and you have the negative, and those show specificity, then you're in good shape. You can do the siRNA. You can do very extensive procedures to go out of the way, I would say, to show that antibody has specificity. But, you know, we don't want to scare the authors and the readers of AJP Heart in thinking that it's going to take you 10 years to validate your antibody. You know, I think there's some minimum controls that would be sufficient.
Okay. I did have a question, and that was the idea of using a negative control in which you're incubating samples with no primary antibody. How frequent do you find that occurring in studies? This is for Mary or Hedwin.
Ideally, it's happening at the first time you use that antibody and that you're working out conditions that include the no positive control.
The other protocol that we used frequently when I was at the NIH was that we would do various dilutions of our antibodies to look at how the primary antibody responded to specific proteins. Now, that was in Western blots. And then we would also use the peptide. We always made our own antibodies, and we'd use the affinity purified peptide against the antibody to sort of pull down the antibody as a negative control. And again, those are things that people can do. Sometimes companies offer the peptide. And if it's the first time you're using an antibody, it might be worth looking into those kind of avenues.
And maybe it should also be pointed out that some antibodies work well for immunoblotting and not so well for histochemistry and vice versa. And they may even be tissue specific. So I think it's up to each investigator to validate and optimize the use of that antibody in their own experiments as they change their experimental paradigm, et cetera.
I noticed your manuscript addressed loading controls, and I think this is such an important and crucial topic. Can you speak a little bit to what are appropriate loading controls for various Western blots or experimentations?
In our lab, we tend to do the whole protein analysis to ensure that there's an equal loading between the samples. And in that way, we don't use a housekeeping gene or protein, because oftentimes when looking at big data sets, you can see that the traditional housekeeping genes are changing in the tissue of interest. So we use the total protein staining. Again, every lab has its favorite. I think as long as you're rigorous in reporting how you do it and justifying if you are going to use a housekeeping gene, whether you've demonstrated that that doesn't change either by RNA or other Western blots.
I second those comments. Our lab uses Ponso staining of the total membrane to show that each lane has equal loading. From a myocardial infarction studies point of view, we examine five common housekeeping genes, including GAPDH. And of those five, only HPRT1 did not change in our samples. And this is at the gene level, not even at the protein level. And so the whole concept of a housekeeping gene, I'm a little skeptical on. And so for our lab, we use the total membrane staining to normalize when we do Westerns.
Well, I think these were all great points. This is a nice discussion. I would advise all of our listeners to go to the original article and use the resources that Hedwin and Mary put in that article. They're really useful, and I hope people go to it and cite it. Don't forget to cite it. And so I thank everybody for participating, and I'm going to turn it back to Kara.
You've been listening to an AJP Heart and Circulatory Physiology podcast. For more podcasts like this one, visit us online at physiology.org/journal/AJP Heart.